We're locked in. Story of my life. My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm a grateful one, too. Grateful is in spirit, but gratitude's about the action part. And I'd like to have a prayer for Craig, who's a solid part of AA, who's in a very challenging way now, and I pray for an optimum outcome in his time of suffering. And I ask you people to have him in your prayers. You people have done quite a number on me over the years, you know. It's been an amazing journey, and I'm here, I guess, to share it. I'd like to begin to thank the committee for picking me from Canada to be the Canadian speaker here. And I'm overwhelmed by the amount of people that come from Vancouver Island, where I'm from. Yeah. I'd like to begin that, first of all, I'm not responsible for what happened to me as a child, but I am responsible for who I became, what I did to myself, and what I did to others. And for that, I'm totally accountable. I had many things that shelled me to play a victim in my role with a persecution complex. It doesn't cut it in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is a solution, you know. I like to talk about my childhood first. Imagine that. Pleas and booze at the age of 4 years of age. My parents left booze behind, hidden behind the curtain, and I said, if they're hiding it from us, it must be good for us, interesting. So we drank a bunch of it, and they came home, and it was a disaster. They had a babysitter that lived next door, so we were loosely surveillanced, you know. And this guy needed more surveillance. But they came home, and I had all these fires under the bed. It was during wartime, 1945. We were living in the east side of Vancouver. And I had all those old-fashioned big matchsticks. We got into that booze, and I created a bunch of fires under all the beds. Well, they come home, and I got a whipping for that. Today, you get charged for putting welts on kids' bodies. So what I did is I went and hung out up at the school up the street. And I hung out at the girls' cooking class, and they felt sorry for me. So they were feeding us until they reported it to the principal, and he phoned the police. And the police showed up, and I jumped into a box, and they pulled me out of it. And he asked my brother who he was. He told him, and he asked me who I was, and I gave him a different name. My brother showed him where we lived, took us there, and they said, are these your children? She says, yes. So what is your name? She says, well, his name is John McCormick, and what is his name? And he says, it's Michael McCormick. Oh, he says, that's not what he told us. He said, he's Harry Jones. I don't know where that come from. Got me in more trouble. We left Vancouver. I had a stepfather then. My father left at when I was 2 years old. He was a staff sergeant in the Army. And he moved to Montreal. We moved up with the staff to Haida Gwaii, the Queen Charlotte Islands out in the North Pacific. And it's the only childhood memories that stay close to my heart and my life. Chasing deer in the meadows, there was no violence around. There was no booze. It was really rustic lifestyle there. But we moved to Prince Rupert, and then I saw violence. And I saw my mom with another man there, and I didn't understand what was going on. And he was colored. And the fight broke out. That stepfather's out of the way. Now we go to Nanaimo, and we pull up in front of this big old house, and there's one that was a bit of a shack beside it. And that colored fella come out, and he says, you see that load of wood? You start hauling it in tomorrow. And I come to understand he resented us kids. He wanted a new beginning with new kids with mom. And so we felt a lot of rejection from him. But it's interesting, as we grew up in the neighborhood, the kids had a problem with the shack we lived in. There were nice homes around us, and they had this racial problem. And they used to beat on us, harass us, and attack us. saying we're in lovers and you live in a shack with one, until one day the drunken stepfather come out and heard what they were doing, and he told me, you go get a club or a baseball bat or you'll get it from me. So I was between a rock and a hard place, so I went and got a baseball bat, and I went out. He validated violence. I wanted approval from him, something from him. But eventually, things changed. A new war started in town, and I was on a path to get even. I started burning buildings down as a kid. No one ever lived in one of those kids. I never burned a building down that somebody lived in, but I burned old sheds and buildings down, and I would go back and watch. There was so much hate in my heart now, wanting to get even. And it became in the papers a firebug. As this carried on, the violence in the home with this new stepfather, the police were in our home all the time. We were down at the cells, and I remember once the police put me in a cell and joked how they weren't going to let me out. Now I hate police. And the neighbors. And I remember my mom saying she wanted a dozen eggs once. And I said, there's eggs in the icebox. We didn't have a fridge. She says, no, that's a code to the bootlegger. It means a dozen beer. So I was getting educated, and the police had a camera on our place for the bootleggers coming. So it was a very healthy childhood upbringing. So anyways, I went to school, and this performance carried on, and we didn't have enough food at home. And I met some of the ragtag kids of my drinking parents. And we decided we needed to get food, and we discovered that the trucks dumped cases of food behind the supermarkets back then, but we needed a way to get it home. And we found a solution, a big black limousine, and the license plates on it were National Defense of Canada. So I guess they were on a mission, but we commandeered that vehicle, and we drove around. We were about 14 years of age, just looking over the dashboard, and we distributed food. And then we turned the car back behind the high school. We drove it up over the mountain down the top, and we turned it back. And then later, I had a taste of booze with some of the buddies, and I saw the magic. The rock and roll days were on then. Feet do your stuff, and I liked the magic. I wasn't a second-class guy anymore, and I liked it so much, I joined in and stole a bunch of wine, and I got caught for it, and I went in front of the judge and says, I have your parents in front of me all the time, and your home's unfit to live in. You have two choices, Brandon Lake Industrial School or foster homes. I took the foster homes because I liked this new party lifestyle. Until it cramped my style, and then I figured a way out of town. I was a ward of the government then from the age of 15 to 21 years of age. I joined a circus, and I traveled all over Western Canada, and I met a few guys, a couple of gangsters that work in the carnivals, and they hooked me up at the P&E and exhibition and some of the roll-down joints. Some of them worked in there, My foster home opened up in Vancouver, and I really tried to get straightened out in my life. And I got into a wholesale clerk down in the East End, and I seen the guys leaning up against the rubbish up against the walls everywhere. And I was a teenager then, and I could never see myself like that. But I started getting into the bars down there underage because I liked the booze too much. And I lost those jobs, and I drifted into crime. And I drifted into crime in Canada and the United States. And I got to know some very serious people in Vancouver. And there was a hit put out on me. And there was a meeting, and I was called to it. And I seen a lot of the powers of the underworld there. And they said, you see Mike there, you leave him alone. And that's what happened, and I just kept my money right, and I kept my mouth shut. But eventually, I got involved with a call girl from Vegas, and I learned that women are fast and I'm slow. We went to San Francisco and we got into it, and I decided I'll fix her and I'll kill me. And I slit my carotid arteries in my artery, and the blood blew out like a hose, and all I saw was the boots of a policeman coming into the San Francisco hotel room, and I was gone. And the next time I lost conscious, I woke up in San Francisco hospital, and they said, "It's a miracle we saved you. We had to go into your arteries in your foot to get a sample of blood." They put me in a nut ward. It was insane. There was a big guy fluttering around there like thinking he was a butterfly. And I needed to find a way out. Anyway, she come back up. We had a spat, went back to Canada, and eventually I separated her from her. And I went to Vancouver Island, and I tried to straighten my life out. And I got into the logging division. I worked right up to the falling and bucking department. But a foreman of the company says, "The company has been given information from the E division from the RCMP, organized crime in Vancouver, about your alleged activities, and they've told us to fire you. And you're in the union, you've been a good worker here, and we've kept you on." And they also were searching my bunkhouse room, they told me. And out drunk one night, and I come home and I have got a revolver. And I thought, where the hell? I had a little idea, but I wasn't sure. But I went and got bullets for it, because the guys up in camp, they all shoot rats at the garbage dump. That's one of the pastimes up there. So I'm up there shooting rats at the garbage dump at night or in the bar. Anyways, that job, I lost that job eventually. It was not to do with the police, but they changed the rate how they paid the fallers. I was on Pete's work. They changed that, and I was a very angry man because I thought the police were behind that. My job's gone. My other half at that time, I thought she was running around on me. I heard about that. Old codependent Mike didn't want to rock the boat or say anything. I knew well enough about rejection. So I left it, and I got home, and I went on a binge, and I woke up 3 days later in the police cells, and this detective came to the cells, and he says, "Do you know me?" And he says, "No." He says, "I went to the same school as you. I remember you there. By the way, when I was in high school, the principal called me and my buddy up to the high school, and he said to my buddy, 'You're the worst in the school, and Michael, you're the second worst. Get your personal effects and get off the property.'" That was my schooling there. Anyways, getting back to this, I said, "Why am I here?" He says, "You don't remember?" I says, "No, I don't." He says, "You're in more trouble than you've ever been in your entire life." They says, "You shot 4 people last night." I said, "What?" He says, "You shot 4 people last night, and you better hope that one of them doesn't die." 2 days later, they came to the cells and said, "Mike, you're now, one of them just died. You're charged with non-capital murder and 3 attempted murder." I went before the judge and jury, and they said, "We hereby declare you a menace to society and hereby sentence you to life imprisonment. Take him away." And they sent me to the British Columbia Maximum Security Penitentiary to start a life sentence. The warden wanted to see me when I got there. And outside his office, I looked up, and there was a picture of Bill W., this picture here, standing on the steps of the BC Penitentiary. He came to see the AA program, 1 year in effect at that time, because he was aware there were people there that belonged in this society. And that was in 1953, Bill W. came there. I went to AA there, but it was a real struggle with the prison code, and AA is the complete opposite. But you know, I went and I thought, I need to make it. It talked about how can I be useful in any society I'm with. So what I did is I got some books and I started designing a fitness program, and it was in the newspapers because they had a small riot. They thought some of the guys that I was involved were up to it, and they weren't. Go on fitness kick. And I designed a fitness from the Swedish standards, the aerobics, everything. And the next thing I know, I had squads of guys training out in the yard, and the guards were freaking. They nicknamed them McCormick's Raiders. They brought in 2 commissioners from Ottawa, from the penitentiary service. because they heard there was some rumbling going on with a potential riot, and they wanted to see four guys out of 652. I was one of the four. Call me head shit disturber. And we're doing a positive thing. Anyways, they did leave, and after a while, the guys destroyed the penitentiary and they had to build a new one. That was the end of the BC penitentiary. It's torn down now, it's all condos, and they built a new one. I didn't get to go in the new one. They sent me to a little better one. It was a penitentiary for drug addicts and alcoholics, and the only thing they did after a million-dollar study, they discovered addicts and alcoholics like chocolate cake. Anyways, booze again. It's a hot summer day, and guys had stashed booze in the vents, home brews up in the vents, and there was a miscount, so they doubled back to check, and they caught the guys with the brews. I'm trying to take one out, and it's in Abbotsford. It's very hot in the summertime, and I got the winter parka on. Being cool, I'll take one out for these guys out of their cell. Over the loudspeaker, Mark McCormick, stop. Out come the police, got the brew, and I was sentenced to the hole for 3 weeks. And that set me back. While I was there, though, I got into Native copper art, and two Native teachers taught me. And they said, you're very good at what you're doing. And they said, enter the prison arts contest in Toronto. My work was sent to Toronto. I won 2 national awards, and my work went across to 60 cities all across Canada. And then they wanted some of the money. And I was going to save to give me a chance when I get out. So I stopped that, and I launched, they had a TV antenna there, and I launched into a master cable antenna system with a satellite dishes, 60-foot antenna on the roof with 11 antennas, and I designed it all picking the brains of antenna people outside. The guards used to take me out on escorted passes up to Victoria City's main antenna, and I'd study it. Anyways, 60-foot tower went up. The guards were freaking. I had 11 antennas, and I had 2 satellite dishes, and they had their own master cable system. Eventually, when I come up to go out on parole, it was headlines, pictures of me and all the front pages and everything, but the next day I had a job with a top satellite company out on the streets. But when I got out the first time, I didn't go to AA. You know, I shucked and jived around, and I had a car accident. And nobody got hurt, but they came to the halfway house and asked me if I was drinking. No, and I said, who are you? He says, I'm the district parole supervisor. Oh, so they took a urinalysis, and a week later, a young lady was ready, and we're going to go out for the evening, and the guys, I was in the halfway house, and the guy said, the young lady's not at the door, but there is somebody else to see you. And I said, who is it? It's the police. So I went to the door, and they said, you're my informant. Yes, he says, we have a warrant for your arrest. I thought it was over the accident. He says, you're going to be going with us. I says, where? He says, to the penitentiary. I said, when? And he said, right now. 30 minutes later, I was back in the hole in the penitentiary. It's the best thing they ever did for me. Because all the guys said, Mike would do good, he'll do great. And I didn't do great. I came back, and it was very humility, and I was between a rock and a hard place. And you know, it's then the parole officer come out and said, you had alcohol in your urinalysis. How do you explain that? Oh, I said, that was my girlfriend. She put some cooking wine in the chicken dumpling stew. That was a terrible mistake, because I probably could have got out in 30 days. It took me almost 2 years. So I learned about what dishonesty is all about. So AA members came out, and bless any of you that carry the message into a prison. And bless you that have never done a day in jail and carried the message into a prison. Because there's people who never did a day in jail but carried the message out there that helped me to be where I am today. So don't ever think you have nothing to offer. It's when I focused on what this disease is all about. And it's what's going on between my ears I haven't explored myself or not allowed anybody else. The psychologists and psychiatrists, they did an assessment. This is the only thing I read off of them. It says, the contributing factors to Mr. McCormick's offense appear to have been alcohol and personal emotional orientation. At the time of his penitentiary placement, he was viewed as being an emotionally unstable person with a multitude of symptoms ranging from schizoid personality disorder, inability to forget and forgive, and immaturity. I hear about the latter seemed to have been impact on his interpersonal relationships, noting that he had a poor marriage. The genesis for his problem appeared to have been his dysfunctional family background, noting that his parents were separated when he was two. He was apparently raised by a number of stepfathers who had problems with alcohol and were physically abusive. So there's the victim now. So what do we do about it? Well, it's really interesting that the members that come in, I connected what this disease is about, the genetic unfitness in the body and the self-centered nature and the deception. I was a master at intellectual deception, and I need to find some reality in my life. And yes, I wasn't very pleased about what I was hearing, and I went back for more the next week when they come out. And they had a 26-week alcohol and drug course the government put on. And I could see my life through it when I was ready to see it. Anyways, the months go by, and the 30 days after 30 days go by, and I'm still there. I created the first race, 10K road race, inside a federal penitentiary in Canada. I had running teams from the street come out, the television, Czech television from Vancouver, the radio stations, they were all out there because this was unheard of. And they asked me where I got my training. I said, running from the police. I was a very fast runner, so it's the chairman of the Royal Victoria Marathon that they put on every year. He's head of the personnel department at Victoria City Hall. And if they sent a letter to the warden, we would like to sponsor Mr. McCormick on our master's team. We believe he can break a sub-3 marathon. So I used to get day passes to his office, and his secretary would usher me in. And they give me the racing, and I became one of the Prairie and Harriers. And a limousine pulled up to take me to the race, and the warden phoned and said, did McCormick get out for the race? Did he ever? A big black limousine come to pick him up. Well, I run that race, and there was a guard that the guys didn't like there, 10 years younger than me, and they found out he was going to be running in that race. So they were getting me extra food out of the kitchen to make sure I was good and strong. I was doing heavy-duty training in there. The guards were complaining to the warden. He's not at his workstation. He says, leave him alone. He's out of my hair. He actually told the inmate committee over the satellite thing that they found I had an illegal tracking system on there. I was really getting programs from other satellites, boxing in Mexico, all kinds of things. But I was out of there then. So he told them I was his worst nightmare. He said he dreamt of me in his sleep, and they sent me there for punishment, and he got it. Anyways, I went and I ran the marathon, and I beat that guard, and I did I broke a sub-3. I did a 2:57.05, and I was in the master's division of over 40. So thanks from all that running from the police, it worked. So anyways, the best part of my story is where you come into it. The first wave of that were people that carry the message into these prisons. People like James here. Bless you, man. See, I'm here because of where it started, where you planted a seed of hope. And then you got me to a point where they took over. So we're a team, we're in this together. So when I got out, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. In my very first meeting, I heard a guy, Wayne, his name, and I saw him just a couple of months ago. A man of 65 years, celebration of life, passed away, Henry, in Victoria. And I had the privilege of having breakfast with him at the Victorious Miracle AA rally the year before. Him and I and my wife, Leslie, and a good friend of his there. But he talked about anger And I says, I'm finally home. I said this to myself. I sat in that chair, and I says, I'm finally home. This is where I belong. And you know, I've stayed. And that was November the 20th of 1986. I haven't had any mood-altering substance since because of this program. It's over 32 years, yes. I started going to AA meetings there, and I ran into a guy, and I should back up on this. He had changed, and we ran wild as teenagers, and I wanted what he had. And I asked him to sponsor me. He said no. This is the first time out, and then they recycled me for the drinking. And he refused. I don't understand it to this day. God must have been at work, because I actually went back and asked him the second time, and this time he says, I'll walk you through the steps. Later I asked him, why did you change your mind? He says, because I saw a change in your attitude. He says, I saw that you were teachable. He said, initially, until you were on strong spiritual grounds, I didn't think you were going to make it, but he says, you surprised me. So you never know when not to give up, and he says, you've really surprised me. And you know that he told me there's some things we're going to do. We had to make an agreement. You see, so I have a choice. Do I want this program or I don't? And he come from an old school, a good school. He didn't mess around with me. He didn't chase after me. He didn't phone it. He didn't do any of that stuff. I wanted recovery. That's what I've discovered. And he helped to teach me. You'll learn about humility, about asking for help, and doing the work. And then he come to me one day, he says, how are you doing? Are you going to meet? Yeah. You're hooking up with people? Nope. He says, you can sit there like Cool Hand Lake in the cell block, and they'll leave you alone. AA will not impose himself on you. This is about you have to reach out. You need to hear something, some guy says. Get his phone number. Let him know that. And you know what I did? I built a group of winners. Because every one of those guys is serious about their recovery, and they're in sobriety today. And I call sober just not drinking. That's a miserable place. The IIT is when you have the steps in your life. That's how I see it. So it brought me to the steps. And step one was the only one that I could take to perfection. Every step I discovered is ego deflating. And, you know, my disease didn't want me to have any part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It looked for where I'm different and all that. And my sponsor says, your disease doesn't want any part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right now, you're on a collision course. Look where you're the same as those people that are happy, joyous, and free, and where you're not. Because if you ever want to see God in action, look at people that are loving and caring. It's just in our big book. The spirit that we should envision for is a spirit of loving and caring. You don't have to see God. Watch people that are loving and caring. You'll see God working through them. It's people that won't judge you, Mike, that become so spiritual holy that they're no earthly good. He said the religion of the churches are for those that are trying to stay out of hell. And the spirituality of Alcoholics Anonymous are for those that have been to hell. I like that. I get that. And bless those that go to church. I have no business. My dad took me in Montreal to those. He had me for 6 months. At 13, he saw the shack I lived in. I thought he was a police detective. He had this whole coat on and everything. He came at 13, and he had the courts declare it was unfit, and he got custody of us for 6 months. I learned a lot about that man. He was on the front page of Times Magazine. His whole picture, sales ad personality of Montreal. He worked, his office was between the president and the vice president of Air Canada, which was called TransCanada Airlines. He was the district governor for Toastmasters of North America for the Quebec region. And he had a good friend that ran the Montreal juvenile delinquent thing, and I ripped the shirt off his back and he sent me to see this guy. And when that didn't work, he drove me out. I was 13 years of age. He drove me out to St. Vincent de Paul Maximum Security Penitentiary. He parked there and he said, son, if you don't learn to control that temper of yours, you're going to end up in a place like that. Well, after the years went by, and I know I'm jugging, the case management called me down at William, and I was getting close now to getting out again. and there's somebody that's looking for you, and we believe it's your father. He'd moved to the west coast to Langley, and he heard about this warden that was letting this marathon runner out to compete in the races, named Michael McCormick. So they hooked us up, and it was my father, and he came out to see me, and he said, "Son, you come from good stock. It's not how far you fall that you get back up again." And that's what he said to me. He saw me in recovery for 10 years, clean and sober, before he passed away. My mother passed away, and I was asked to do the eulogy up in the town where I shot all the people. Well, I showed up there, and I see a whole row of motorcycles out front, and I'm not a biker. Then I see a whole bunch of guys with the Hell's Angels across on their jackets, and they got the whole back row, so they're there to pay Mom respect. Apparently unknown to me, my young brother was involved with them. And Mom used to do the seamstress and all her curtains up at their clubhouse. She was a little white-haired. She's a little white-haired warhorse. They loved her. They were giving her champagne at New Year's. I was in the penitentiary. Then I was told that she did sew the patches on when they were warranted a patch. I said, "Oh my God." And I found that out just 2 years ago about that part. She's the black sheep in her family. When she went to get her job at the post office, they asked her how many languages she spoke. She said, "Three." And then said, "What are they?" "French, English, and profanity." They hired her. You know, but she saw me too for 10 years in recovery, you know, and I went and did the eulogy there. And you know, the people were all there to pay their respect to her, and that's all that matters, you know. The gang I live in is a hood, and it's the AA hood, and it's solid and it rocks. You know, and I see these young comers at the treatment centers in Canada, and I see you hip, slick, and cool guys there, you know. I says, "I mean, you come out of all your hoods, get in the AA hood, it's solid and it rocks." And I'm going to get back to step two now. The unmanageability of step one, I didn't have to get a second opinion on that. Because I went through three withdrawals. The withdrawal from the booze, the withdrawal from that society I ran with, that was addicting to me. And the third withdrawal was from the self-contaminated me, I, self, and me, through the 12 steps of the program. So coming to believe in a power greater than myself, I told an old timer, "You know, I get the war stories, I'm not going to get the God thing." And he smiled at me, he's relaxed, and he said, "Relax, you're right on course for a newcomer. Just bring the body, God will show up later." So I came to meetings and I saw changes were happening that I can't take credit for. And I came to believe. And I remember my sponsor, we did a step three at his place. He said, "You're too humble to get down on your knees." And I says, "No, I'm not." So I got down on my knees and we said out the step three prayer. "I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to remove the self-centeredness and self-obsession. Take away my difficulties so that I may better do your will. Let your will, not mine, be done." Step four tells me to pray to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And this is where I had an issue that kept me sick that I couldn't share with my sponsor. And he sent me to James D., who has 51 years now. He started the other program, Narcotics Anonymous, in Canada. He was the guy that started it in Canada. And he also is in this program because they got their program from Alcoholics Anonymous. It's inside their big book. This is the horse's mouth. So, I decided to really open up, and it was about me being sexually molested when I was 14 years old in a foster home. They rented out some rooms to some pipeline welders, and one of them really thought he was a great guy and really good to me, and he sexually molested me, and I hated myself for that, and it carried with me. and I couldn't tell my sponsor about that, and now I'll tell the world. And I went to James, and I laid everything out. He worked with me for, he was given the contract by the penitentiary parole board to work with me for 5 years, because the psychologist and psychiatrist were monitoring me. They weren't giving me feedback. I needed to get feedback, and he gave that to me. And my sponsor wanted me to see him. So it was really the step work that we really did into step 4 and 5 and about God. Got through that. We had 90 sessions throughout that 5 years. And so step 4 is discovery, and step 5 is insight into what I've discovered. And the masks were ripped away, and I didn't like who I was. And I needed to make changes about that. So in step 6, to be entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I didn't want to hang on to them. The tragedy that I created in my life, both to others and what I put myself through, I didn't want to have that in my life anymore. So in step 7, I asked that higher power, I offer myself to thee, to remove every single defect of character that I have, and to do his will always. Demand nothing. Demand is arrogance. Arrogance is ego. E-G-O, edging God out. Step 7. Step 8. I made the list. And I knew I would not have to deal with victims. It was against the law. And when I read in the newspaper, I understand they wish I was dead. But something happened. Do you know, you get a conscience in this program. And I got a phone call from my family. He says, you know the guy that you shot that's in a wheelchair? He wants to see you. And what happened is my brother that runs with that bike club got into a minor jackpot, and they sent him to dig a drainage ditch in that guy's yard. And my youngest brother's mulatto, different last name, so they never connected him to me, but he got to realize that that was my brother. Anyways, he said he wanted to see me, and my brother said, I should caution you one thing, Mike. He's taken up target practice at the Nanaimo Rifle Gun Club. Ooh. So anyways, it was against the law. The police had banned me from the town. But it started to really bother me now. And this program is about doing. Because I started obsessing about it. And I now have a choice. I pray to God, what is your will in this? And it said to go. So my backup sponsor, he says, Mike, I'll go with you. So the police didn't know. We went up, my brother arranged, all he said, I said, do not tell him I'm coming, just say you're coming over for coffee. Because he asked my brother twice, is Mike coming? And Mike's not coming, is he? Mike's time isn't right. I wasn't to step 9 yet. I needed to understand where I am to be prepared to go there. It was a blackout. I didn't remember it. I heard all the witnesses and what they said. So the day came. We walked up the road, and a block away, my backup sponsor stopped. He said, this is as far as I go. I says, I thought you were coming with. No, the rest of the walk is between you and your higher power. So we went up to the door. My brother knocked on it, stepped away, and he says, to the fellow came to the door in the way. He says, there's somebody here you wanted to see. I stepped in the door and saw the wreckage of my past. But you know, you people gave me the courage. God worked through you for me to step up to the plate. Because if I can get through that, I can grow. He invited me in, and I just hugged him, and I said, I love you, man. I regret what I did to you. I didn't remember it, and there's not a day that goes around in my life that I don't think about it. I'm free of the sentence today, but I'm never free of the memories. I said, what I've done about you and the others is I've changed. I'm not that person anymore. And I did that through a wonderful fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. There's people there that showed me how to clean up who I was and become a decent human being. God is in my life. I say, someday I pray medical science can take you out of that chair. But I spend my life being of service to AA to hopefully stop others from doing what I do. I told them I go into prisons and I share there. And he blew me away and he said, thanks for coming, Mike. Apparently the witnesses said he came after me. I'd left the place, was staggering away from it. He came after me to try and capture me. Step four says I need to own all of that because he came out of the place to capture me because of the people I shot inside. It's just that plain. That's how my sponsor looked. Where did the ball get rolling? It started with me. Never mind that he put himself in a dangerous place. I set it up. So I own that. So what had happened then? He said, thanks for coming, Mike, because I can start healing now. Wow. And I walked out of his yard. I was a different guy. And it says, before we're halfway through this phase, we'll get to know the promises. The promises are in my life. I got another phone call. I carried the message. I got into intergroup rep for a while, and when I couldn't do that, I got a job in the shipyard. And the Vancouver Shipyard, their Victoria Division. And the head foreman, I used to go to step groups at his home. And we had a 10-person men's step group, and that group was amazing for me. But I carried the message into the main alcohol and drug detox for 9 years, and they pulled me aside. And isn't this ironic when one door closes, another one opens? I had hepatitis C virus, and I didn't want to do it. They said, you can't wait. I got the most advanced Hep C team, Dr. Frank Anderson out of Vancouver, his team, and it took almost 2 years. They were worried because I'm psychiatric. I did suicidal ideation in the past. But you know, I prayed and I prayed and I used this program. And my wife, Leslie, used to go for walks. She's been an amazing person in my life. You know, and the first cocktail didn't work. The next one did. It knocked it out and they said, you're free of the virus. You don't have it any longer. And at that time, that detox phoned me and they said, pulled me aside and they said, you know, you've been coming in here for 9 years. They said, the director's hiring a staff member and we've recommended you. Why me? They says, it wasn't us. He says, it was the clients over the years. It's their feedback. You've been the most asked for out of all the people that come in here to share the message. So they made it easy for us to extend. So I had an interview with the director, and I assumed he knew about me because all the line staff did. He didn't. He said, we do a criminal record check. I says, you do. He says, do you have one? Honesty? Hey, James. I says, I do. What? Can you tell me what it was? And I told him, and he went pale, and he sunk back, and I went paler. I went home to Leslie, and I says, Leslie, it was terrible. He didn't know about me, and I told him, and he was in a bad way when I left. It's going to the board of directors, and there's a high-level police on it, psychologists, they're all on the board. Anyways, I come back in 2 weeks, and he called me, and he says, I guess you want to know what the decision is. Well, we found out that There's five types of murder, and yours was a crime of passion. You're the least likely to ever reoffend that crime on any statute of the book. He said, they recommend that we hire you on a probationary basis for 6 months and see how you do. I worked there for 10 years and retired from there after 10 years of working for alcoholics. We're just getting going now. Then I get another phone call. I was working half time there at that time. My parole officer phoned me and he says, we got a job for you. I says, you do? Yeah, it's for a lifer that's out in the community and you're our top role model out there. I says, where it is? He says, it's working in the federal penitentiary where you did 7 of your 13 and a half years. I said, what? Yeah, you'll be working with other guys, looking at their programs, seeing if drug, alcohol, are they realistic about what their plans are? Long-time offenders, been in for years. So I thought about it, and I went up to the gate, and an old guard was there, and he said, is that you, Mac? And I said, yes. He says, what the hell are you doing out here? I says, I'm coming to work here. He says, you're what? I says, there's keys for an office. I'll give you the key. Oh, he says, that's down where the psychologists and psychiatrists are. I says, I'm not here to get my head examined anymore. He says, I'll have to phone the warden's office. I says, phone him. He phoned the warden's office. He got off the phone, and he looked at the other guard, and the warden said, give Mac the keys. This program can take you places. Well, I'll tell you, there were some guards in there that were really power tripping when I was in there as a prisoner. God is a great leveler. I worked there for a year and a half, and I went full-time at detox. Some other things I did also. Oh, you get tests in this program. We moved into a neighborhood. I met Leslie almost 6 months from the beginning, a quiet, well-dressed young lady in the meetings, and I never connected her and I together. But she'd come and talk to me, and people saw her talking to me, they told her, run. So anyway, she didn't run, but they meant well, because guys get out, they don't have their act together, most. So anyways, our sponsors, when they knew it, they said, the only way you're going to find out is try it, but you better have the God of your understanding close, you better be working the steps and keep us close. And you know, we did, and for a time, it went fine, and then we did have to separate for 4 months. And for that 4 months, I was working at Shipyard. I was in a step group. She was active in her journey. And we started phoning each other. And they had that AA rally that year when we met at the Empress, Fairmount Empress Hotel in Victoria. She came over and wanted to see this little bachelor place because all I knew was living in a prison cell for all those years. And when I come out, she quickly moved me over to her place. So he looked at the little place I had. She says, you're doing a lot better than I thought you would. That's the program. Anyways, we did get back together. We had to get some couples counseling, and how perfect. I said, if it's a woman, she'll be sticking up for you. If it's a guy, we got a man and wife team. James D., who knew me inside out, and his colleague, Bonnie. And we laid our issues out, not to each other, but we laid them out to make them transparent there. And man, they helped us through that, and we have not had a problem since going through that to couple. I ask that we have other AA couples come to our place to ask about stuff as they're getting together, and we love that. So we share what we do with them. To me, what a wonderful thing to do. We bring them over to our home. They want to know different things, and we tell them. But it all starts with the program. I was told, it's not what we get out of the relationship. What can I bring to this relationship with Leslie? What do I have to offer? That's what I need to do. Not it's about what I'm getting anymore. It's what can I bring? So step 10 is really a condensed 4 to 9. Taking my daily inventory. And when I'm wrong, promptly admitted it. See, I can't have anything going on because obsession is like a wedge. It just starts with a little bit and it'll work away and it'll own me and it'll become bigger than I can handle. James D. told me, Mike, he's moved up 30 kilometers from where we live. He phoned me last week after all these years. And he says, Mike, I'm on this side of your mountain now. I'm retired. And I'd like the lovely presence of you and Leslie for dinner at our home. And this was just last week. So we're on a new journey with this man. He says, I had you as a client, and today we're in friendship. And that's what we do with sponsors and sponsees. We start with a sponsee sponsor, and we blend that into friendship. That's how I see it. But I'll come to that, to this point. But step 10, I need to be vigilant, and James really helped me a lot with that one, about being vigilant and that obsessive nature. Step 11, thought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand and praying only for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. Well, having a spiritual awakening, especially in step 11, I thought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him. And that was really important for me because I had to develop a higher power. And I tell my higher power every day, God, will you grant me the best understanding of your will that I may have and the grace and courage to carry that out? And if there's something that I'm troubled about, I'll mention that at the same time. We go to a meditation group, in a group one, and we do it alone. We each have our own program. We don't mess with each other's program. But we 12-step each other a lot, too. You know, we've grown up together. And step 12, having had that spiritual awakening. In the literature, it talks about the spiritual experiences and the spiritual awakening. And he says, it's more common today that it's a spiritual awakening of the educational variety. It doesn't matter how we get there, that we find a spiritual connection with this program. Working with others. I have two sponsees in my life. My sponsor told me, you don't sponsor more than two people at any one time. Because when they're needy, you need to be there for them. And he said, there's a third person that you have to be vigilant about, and that's yourself. So there's three. And in our home group, when a newcomer comes in, if we're available, we put our hand up so they know. We also give them a phone list. We also personally go up and greet them and meet them. There was a couple of times guys asked me to sponsor them. I always ask this now, I learned this. I says, is this your desire? Well, no, why, whose is it? Well, my wife told me to get you. The ulterior motives. And the other one is girlfriend. So I think it's important when they see why they need to ask me. You know, and important thing about sponsorship, it's important that we don't focus on how popular we are or who we are, but more important, focus them into what the steps are and how we got here. Because I only have this program at the grace of a higher power and the people that are in my life. I have one of the sponsees that came over when I moved to Ladysmith. Another thing is I like to have eye contact with them. Unless I've sponsored them for a long time, I like to have eye contact with them, body talk. It doesn't match what they're saying. I learned that in the penitentiary interviewing guys. They have quite a science of interviewing guys in there. They know body talk, they know what it means. It's amazing what they do. But I always say, if I have some feedback they may not like to hear, it's how I say it. I say, I have some feedback from what you've said to me, would you like to hear it? That gives me permission at their choice. They're in control of this. And then I tell them. And I say that because I care about you. Guys handle that better. I heard a spiritual speaker once, universally across all cultures, they say women's greatest fear is being abandoned. And men across all cultures is being vulnerable. That's the machismo. Victoria University, she came to speak there. So interesting to know. Interesting to know my wife as a woman and how she is to respect her sensitivities. It's not all about me. We're partners in that relationship, and God's got to be an important part of it too. There was a neighbor learning how to be in a neighborhood. Big Al was his name. And he moved in next door, and he says, if you can't get along with me, you can't get along with anybody. Well, this guy pulled up and glared at me, unless he was out on the porch, and says, boy, did that guy ever glare at you? Do you know who he is? And I look, and I says, oh my God, he's a police officer where I used to have to report for parole. Well, his mother lived behind us. The neighborhood changed. The next thing I know, I think I'm in a police station. He's got a police scanner, and he's got it outside our window, and it's cranked up. I went to my foreman at the shipyard and told him, what do you do about that? He says, you get a gun, aim it at this police scanner, and shoot it. I says, I can't do that. My sponsor says, you be very careful where you ask your information, Mike. Anyways, this is one time I phoned the police on me. And I said, would you please lock me up? They said, well, we have to have a reason. I says, I don't want to give you a reason. He says, who are you? And I told them, they were out to my place in a flash. They went in the bedroom, click, click, on his police scanner, and they went around the corner. He said, oh, I guess you're here to see me, eh? They said, as a matter of fact, we are. Is that your police scanner? Put it in the house. He says, why? Your neighbors are complaining. So they left, and we thought, it's all good, peace, love, and granola. The next thing I hear, McCormick, come out of there. Oh, and I'm trembling, not about me, but is that guy gone inside me? I'm being threatened now. And remember, there's a line in the big book, we don't crawl, we're not second-class people, we don't crawl to anyone. We stand with dignity for ourselves. And I went out in my yard. And Leslie pulled into the car and heard him yelling, I know who you are. And she said, and where did you access that information? Well, he didn't say. I says, I don't know what your problem is, but I says, you want to thank God that's not who I am today. I don't know. We've wished you moved in. We've wished you the very best as good neighbors. I don't know how to get it across from you. And then a stunner happened. I can't believe it. My wife was shocked, and I was. I threw my arms around him in a bear hug, and I pulled him, and he says, I love you. And he just looked at me. God put those arms around him, because that's not what I had in mind. He went home, and it says, you pray for him what you have for yourself. So we're at this end of the lake. I prayed for him to move him at the other lake, at the other end. Here's my witness. I prayed for 3 months and says, Mike, you better get down to the bedroom. There's a moving truck moving in. And they moved out and they split up. Guess where he moved? Halfway down the lake to his son's home, was back from teaching English in Japan. Here's an amazing thing that happened with that. Is I saw him once in a department store. He saw me, and he was a shadow of the big guy he was, and he went lurking along the edge when he saw me. And you know what was in my heart? I felt sad for him. I had a God moment. All this resentment or revenge, and it's gone. I felt sad for him. And the other thing with the guy that molested me, that was the last thing that shook me, I did a computer search. I checked all over where he lived and everything, and bingo, I saw his name in Calgary. So I said, I've got to ask him something with 3 different coordinates in it to make sure that's him before he knows who I am. And so I said, is this so-and-so, and you've got a brother so-and-so, and you're a pipeline welder? He said, that's me. God. He says, who is this? I says, Mike McCormick. Mike McCormick? Yeah, I was the kid in the foster home, and I didn't go into that right away. I says, you guys were pipeline welders up. Oh, I heard he died in the car accident. No, he's alive. He's just talking to you right now. He says, well, how you been doing? I says, well, not that good. He says, well, where you been? I says, I was locked up in a penitentiary. I was sentenced to life for a mass shooting of people for some unfinished rage in me that was built around shame. I says, something you did to me. He says, I'm sorry about that. He says, are you still locked up? I says, no, they've turned me loose. He says, I can tell you the trim of your house, the car you're driving. I use Guthurgle. Google, you know, from space down. Looked all around, drove up and down the street with Google Drive. And I says, you know, I wasn't decided whether to go to the Calgary City Police on you. But you know, I have a God in my life. And you have two daughters and a wife. I don't have any right to add stigma to them. So I'm letting this go now. And I hung up. And I've left it dead, and I got a test. We went to the Rocky Mountains, we went to Alberta, Leslie and I, to see friends of ours. And we drove right through his city, Calgary. We were hiking in the Rockies. And we got back to home, and I said, oh my God, Les. We drove right through Calgary, and I never thought about him. I'm free. I'm free. Another thing that happened, 26 miles radius from where we live, they had to report to the police. Eventually I said, we joined a hiking club. That was her idea, and we went to the Rocky Mountains. We loved it. We're up in a mountaintop. We said, this is being high. So the next thing I know, I go to my parole officer, and I says, we want to go on a hiking trip. Where? He says, oh, to the Mount Everest region of Nepal. You know, we want it all the way. Well, I organized a trip because I was guiding groups for Club Tread Outdoor Society in Victoria. Backpack expeditions, I learned how to do all that stuff to give back to the community. And we ended up blasting off to Singapore, Korea, to Kathmandu, and I climbed mountains up there, and there was a guy that was dying from advanced altitude at 14,000 feet, and I tried to be instrumental in organizing to save him. And when I got back to Kathmandu from the Mount Everest region, there was an email. It said, thank you from Japan. He was a leader there in Japan. And his two partners were there to say how I tried to instrumental save his life. I don't do anything. It's God working through me. I can be the willing partner. My sponsor always told me, the thing that you take credit for is willingness, Mike. None of this would have happened if you weren't willing. God's doing the rest. And you know, I got a letter from his youngest daughter that they brought the bones, the ashes of it, and thanked me for trying to do the right thing. You know, stop wreaking havoc in society. And somebody says, you know what's happened in your life? That one day you were declared a menace to society, and today you're an asset to society. And I'm going to leave the best to last. I've got a sponsor. And he come over, he's 35 years old, a young guy, we had a chat, and then the next time he brought his wife over, and I met her. He said, I'd like to meet my little daughters. They're 4 and 6. Over they come, and they're high energy. Our place is alive, the kids are in everywhere. And he says, you know, my family really loved you and Leslie, and my two little daughters' grandpa passed away. And my two little daughters come to me, and they said, can Mike and Leslie be our other grandpa and grandma? Thank you.